Welcome to the Voices of Grambling, a digital oral history podcast, a series exploring the rich, nuanced history of Grambling State University, the city of Grambling, and the people who make it. This series is a collaborative project between students and faculty of the History Department of Grambling State University, as well as faculty from the University of Arkansas. The Voices of Grambling, a digital oral history project, has been made possible in part
by a grant from the Albert LePage Center for History and the Public Interest at Villanova University. This season is part of their Cities and Historical Perspective thematic investigation and will focus on the economic, racial, and social history of the city of Grambling through conversations with former business owners and city officials.
Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of
the LePage Center for History and the Public Interest, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Social Science Research Council, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities.
Welcome. My name is Edward Holtz, and I'm here today with Mr. Raven. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we get started, if you just go ahead and introduce yourself, maybe give a little bit of background, a little bit about yourself.
Oh, my name is Bobby Raven, and I grew up in Grambling, but I was not born here. I was born south of here, about 30 miles, in a place called Bear Creek. That's near a town called Beanville. And my first life experiences was down there. We lived in a rural area on a farm during World War II, and we were sort of isolated. You know, we were not around a whole lot of people. I started school in down there. We went to a one-room schoolhouse, believe it or not. There was one room about the size of this office. and we had grades 1 through 7 in it. And as a first grader, I sat on the back row and was ignored for a year and expected to be able to read at the end of the year. But anyway, I managed to memorize the book and read it, so I was okay. My memories of that area of my life is that we had to walk to school, and the roads were gravel and muddy, and it was cold, and we had to walk 2.5 miles to school each day. And we had to pass by a school to get to our school. We had to pass by a modern school at the time, a brick building with windows and everything, to get to our school, which was not modern and you know, substandard. And anyway, my greatest memory of that time is walking to school one morning. It was cold and rainy, and the bus with a bunch of white kids passed us by, and they were taunting us, laughing at us for having to walk in the rain and the mud. And the bus driver didn't even stop to pick us up. That kind of made me upset. Even though I was a little kid, I was still upset. So that kind of bothered me, you know. Anyway, and then we finally moved to Grambling, mainly because my brothers had finished the 7th grade and there was no place to go except. So we moved and we came to Grambling. But while we were down there, I think my father was a sharecropper, but I'm not sure because he never said. But when I got older and started reading about sharecropping, he was a sharecropper. And so we had no money and very little anything. So we moved to Grambling in 1946. And that's when things changed. In Grambling, when we moved to Grambling, Grambling was very, very, very tiny. It was really in two sections, north section and south section. We were on the south side of the campus. And the north side of the campus was a mile away. So we lived a mile away from the campus. And we were on that end. And people on this end. So we never intermingled that much except at school because of distance and travel. There were no cars in Grambling. There were 3 cars in Grambling that I can recall when I got here. There was 2 taxis and President Jones had a car. And that's what I remember seeing. So we walked there where we went. And so you're restricted when you have to walk.
Before we get to Grambling, do you have any other memories about life on the farm?
Well, you had very limited resources. If you see an old movie of the 18th, like an old Western movie from back in the day, you see the kind of life I lived in my early years. The house that we lived in, you could see the pigs under the house through the floor crack. And you had to put newspaper over the wall to keep the wind from blowing through in the wintertime. And and it'd be so cold in the house, your front would be burning up and your back would be freezing. So you'd keep turning around in front of the heater to keep warm. And we formed, and we had to make our toys. We had to create our own toys and everything like that. We roamed through the woods, and it wasn't bad for a kid. It was bad for an adult, I guess. You bathe once a week, you know, which is, and so I'm sure we didn't smell too good.
You said that you read more about sharecropping, and you believe that your family were sharecroppers in that period. Can you elaborate on what aspects maybe led you to believe that they were sharecropping?
Okay, well, one thing, they were sharecropping because they never had any money. And they were always tied to the land. And every year, he never could break out of the indebtedness. And I had two older brothers, and when they got older, my daddy was still farming, but they were farming. He found a job outside of farming. And from that time, then we gradually got out of that mode of being a sharecropper. And so then he began to not have to depend upon, the stuff he could own the store, and he kept the books. So you never got ahead as for you never knew what the books said because you didn't see the books. That's why I think he was a sharecropper. No, he didn't say, but I think he was.
When you said that he had the books, do you know who your father was working for?
Yeah, his name was Hayes. It was Hayes, I think it was, yeah.
Do you remember anything about Hayes?
Yeah, he was a loud man, boisterous. He was not as mean as he sounded. He sounded mean and rough and gruff, but he really, really, really was not quite so obnoxious as he sounded, but he sounded very obnoxious. You know, like one day we were kids and we were sneaking around stealing some of his pecans. He hollered at us and screamed like he was going to kill us, but you could tell in his voice that he didn't really mean it. You know, it's kind of inflection and intonation that you get the meaning from. So I felt that he was a victim of the times because people sometimes are not what they are, not what they seem. They are a part of the culture in which they're in, and that culture kind of determines their actions, even though they're not necessarily that way themselves.
So your family moved to Grambling in 1946. Did your family come and farm, or what did your family come and do for work when they got here?
But first year he farmed, and then the second year he got a job, and my brothers farmed. So we farmed. Then after they left, then my other, there were four boys, the two older sons, when they left, then the farming fell to my next brother and me. So we actually farmed us in 1953. But he didn't farm. He drove truck, but we farmed until 1953, and then we stopped farming after that.
Was the farm owned by your family?
Oh, no, that farm was, the land belonged to Hayes, and we farmed it on his land. We had no land.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So even up here in the Grambling area, the farm belonged to Hayes?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any other memories about what Grambling was like in the 40s when you got here?
Yeah, Grambling was very small. When I got here, Grambling campus consisted of the square where Long Jones Hall is. The library was the first building, this side of Main Street. Then the gymnasium was the second, where the museum is now, was the second building. That was the gymnasium. Then you turn the corner to Long Jones Hall, then Druid Hall, and then Dining Hall, where Grambling Hall is now. Those were the main buildings on campus. There had one male dormitory down north of open space by the old library. It was a two-story white building, and they had Jewett Hall was a female dormitory, and they had one other dormitory back where the cafeteria is now for the women. So women had two dormitories, men had one. And I don't know where the rest of the students stayed, but that's where they were. And then behind Jewett Hall, there was some houses that faculty members stayed in at the time. And those were old buildings from the POW camp that was located three or four miles north of here, west of here, and they've moved those buildings onto this campus, a lot of them.
you mentioned the POW camp, Camp Ruston. When you got here in 1946, do you remember anything or were there any conversations about the POW camp?
They talked about it, yes, but there were no POWs here at the time. They had all been gone, shipped back. But they talked about it. That's where all of our equipment came from there. Trucks came from there. Buildings came from there. Dormitories came from there. They, you know, they had barracks that they called them, came from there. Mm-hmm. And so that's... And I lived in one of the barracks that came from there when I was in school. Yeah.
Along those lines, you know, and Grambling didn't just have the university. You also have the town of Grambling. And so there were what we call the village. What do you remember of the village?
I was not in the village that much because I lived about a mile from the village. And so I was still kind of small. But what I remember was there was a spot cafe across near where the post office is, not in that area, but not at that spot. And there was a Mike's Cafe, which is on the east side of the street. And it was a place. Then there was a two-story white building that had a Brown's Cafe was there. And that down the street, they had Turner's Tailor Shop in Grambling. And that's where I remember about the town of Grambling. Now, there's some things that had been there earlier from what I understand, but I never saw them.
You said you went to Grambling. What years were you here?
Yeah, I went 57 through 60.
Anything you want to share about your time as a student at Grambling?
Oh, boy. Let me see. I was an athlete. I was on football scholarship number one. They wanted me to play basketball, but I didn't do it. But I should have played basketball because I only weighed 170 pounds, and I played center. So that was a mistake. I was more studious than a lot of people, I guess. So I would spend a lot of time in the lab and a lot of time in my math classes and stuff like that. So and then when I wasn't in class, I was out working because I would cut grass for people and clean houses and take wax off floors and drive taxi and all kinds of things. So I really didn't do a lot of the crazy things that people do, which I wish I would have now, but it's too late. One thing that happened, we went to play Texas Southern in Houston, and we came back that night. We got back about just about daybreak. When I got ready to get to my bed, my roommates had taken my bed and they'd taken a bag of water and put it under the sheet. And if I would sat on that bed, but I happened to see the sheet begin to move, and then I found out that it was water, and that's the most memorable thing ever happened. And the second thing was that one night after football practice, the guys, I was going to join the Omega Psi Phi fraternity, and God told me, so he wanted me to go get him some goodies from Crow's taxi stand, which is down his village. I told him he better go do something to himself. I didn't say what, but and I quit. So I didn't become an Omega for that reason because he wanted me to go there. And I just got through playing football. I was tired. I wasn't going to do that. And they were going to punish me for not doing that. I said, no, you're not punishing me, baby. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it. So I didn't do it. So I'm not an Omega.
So you said you stayed in one of the former barracks for that as the dorm. Can you describe a little bit about what were the dorms like?
Four people to a room. And each dorm had two bathrooms. One at the bottom. The building was divided into two halves, I guess, per floor. It was two floors. So you had one restroom on this half and one restroom on that half for all the students. And the same thing up top. So in a building 100, 200 feet long, you had maybe two bathrooms, two restrooms, two shower rooms. And that's what we had. That was the kind of accommodation. We had four to a room. And so we didn't have any, because we didn't have all the stuff that people have now. We had no radio, no TVs, none of that. Didn't have, you know, so we didn't have anything but just clothes having our backs usually. So you could put four into a room, okay, but not, you know, you couldn't do it now, but you could do it then. Mm-hmm.
What was it like having Pres Jones as the president?
I was in school with his son, so I knew him. Plus my mother worked in his house, so I knew him. I got pretty well connected with him, and I met him a lot. He was a nice man. He was really a good guy. He was all right. He was all right. But his son, I played basketball with the son, so I knew him pretty well, and he was all right. I liked him, and you know, mm-hmm. he was okay with me. Plus, he was visible. He was a good man in the sense that you knew he cared about what was going on. I mean, it wasn't like he didn't, you knew he was genuine, put it that way. You knew that. You just knew that.
And one of those moments of visibility would be at those convocations, at those meetings that he had. Tell me some about these convocations that were held in the 50s.
He was comical, but he was also instructional. And I remember this one lady from somewhere, I don't know her name, but she was talking about how impressed she was with him, how he could talk about go home and talk to your parents and go home and kiss your mule and stuff like that. You know, he made comical statements, but he was getting this point across. And he was very entertaining, but he was also serious about what he was trying to accomplish. And plus, he was well-known all over the state. I got a job in Abbeville by accident. I got the job mainly because I mentioned I went to Grambling and prayers with my president. I got hired based on that statement, basically because the man knew nothing about me, and I knew nothing about him. But when I mentioned prayers, he said, okay, you're hired. I said, okay, fine with me.
You know, what were some of the things that he taught at the convocations?
He would just say to go home and don't be a phony, be real. Don't go home like you're supposed to be educated. Don't go home and degrade your uneducated peers. You know, you don't let that get to your psyche. Stuff like that. You know, he was just down to earth and sort of be who you are and don't let your title determine who you are. Let's be who you are. That's the message I got.
You mentioned a job down in Abbeville, but another one of the careers that you had was working at Crow's Taxis. Can you tell us a little bit about Crow's Taxi?
Crow was a nice man. He was a big man, tall. He was taller than I was. Big man, but real nice. He ran a taxi stand he sold little Nick next to the kid because he had no store. He sold what we call stage flanks, pie, big drinks. We got at night and get our food at night when we got hungry. He'd keep that open. And when I worked for him, part-time. I was not fully employed. I was just the guy he knew, I guess. And see, I had done work for everybody in Grambling down there. I made gardens for people. I painted for people. I cut people's grass. I did all kinds of stuff. And I guess everybody knew who I was in Grambling. But anyway, that's how I got with him. When he needed somebody to drive taxi, he would call me or find me if he could. When I was not in class, I would drive taxi. So that's how I got the job. It wasn't a job. It was just like, I would go by and he would tell me, I need you to come drive for somebody at such an hour, and I'd go pick him up.
So you worked while you were in college, you worked a little bit after college. When did you work?
I was in school. It was not working. I was just in my free time. I did that. It was not a job per se, because I was not on the books, but it's so safe. So I was just the guy who would drive. See, when he couldn't go, he would ask me to go for him. Mm-hmm. And when I could, I would.
How did people let Mr. Crow know that they needed a taxi?
They would call down. He had a telephone. They had a dormitory. In the dormitory, they would go down to the major's office and call and say they needed to go to Shopping and Russell. They would call him, and then he would pick them up, or he would send me to pick them up. If I was available, I'd go. If he was available, he'd go. Mm-hmm. So, but most times when I was available as much as I could be, but I had other things to do. I was like football and the lab. You got to go to lab and doing chemistry. You got to go to lab, and that kind of tied me down a little bit. You know.
Can you describe a little bit about the building, the rooms where the taxi service was?
It was in a room. I'm guesstimating now. The building is still there. It's across from the statue. When you turn it behind the old library, it's back there. It was about 12 to 15 feet by maybe 10 feet deep. It was small. It was a very big building. So he just had a stand there. He kept a refrigerator. He kept those soft drinks and knick-knack stuff. It wasn't really a big operation. The operation was really taxing. He didn't need a big stand for that. Mm-hmm. But he'd go there and guys would go there and play dominoes. I didn't do it, but Ernie Ladd and that bunch would go there and play dominoes and all kinds of stuff in the place. So he had a little concession stand, I would imagine, something like that. They would go and play dominoes, then they'd buy little pops and things of that nature, you know.
How many people drove for Crow's Taxi?
As far as I know, I'm the only one that drove. Just me and him. At the time, maybe after I left, I don't know who. You know.
Where were you taking people?
Okay. See, in Grambling at the time, there was no place you could buy, like, you couldn't buy anything in the clothing line or the shoe line. You could buy only, even food you had to go to Russell Dunnett to get, pretty much, you know, because there were no stores like that in Grambling. So I would pick them up at the dormitory, wherever they resided, and take them to Ruston to whatever store they wanted to go to. And they would shop, and I would probably come back, make another trip, and on the next, get them back on the next trip, and I would pick them up on the corner somewhere. There was no place for them to meet. We used to meet on the corner to pick them up and bring them back. You know, it was, see, Ruston back in those days was, Ruston was Jim Crow to the max. Back in those days, see, I grew up in Grambling, so I'm lucky in a way, but I was not in that mode very often. But back then, you couldn't, if you're walking down the street, you had to, and a white girl was coming, you had to get off the street and let her pass, okay? If you look at her, you could be possibly beating her home. It made it kind of tough. By my not living in Ruston, I didn't go through that much. I was in Grambling, so I didn't have to live with that much. But when I went down there, you had separate restrooms and separate this and separate that. You couldn't even buy a hamburger in the same window. You're outside, and you can buy a hamburger in the same window. You know, it was kind of disgusting. And that's how it was. And you had no rights. You couldn't go to the front door of a white person's house. You had to go to the back door. One day I was working in Ruston at a lady's house, and I was raking leaves in the yard, and this is how things were. And I was raking, and she had a big yard, so I was raking out in the open space. And this girl was coming toward me. She was white, and I was raking leaves, and she stopped and started talking to me. And here I am standing out there in the middle of a field, wide, wide open spaces, talking to this white, I wasn't talking to her, she was talking to me, talking to this white girl. I'm sitting there saying, get the hell away from me, to myself. Don't leave me alone. Don't stand there, move, get away. But I couldn't say that because I couldn't be disrespectful to her because, you know, that's how the rule was. And she sat there and she talked maybe 5 minutes or so. And she finally left. And then what's so ironic now, if this is not, I don't understand this at all. I didn't want her there, but when she left, I wanted her back. I want her not to have left. I mean, I don't even understand that emotion at all. I don't understand that to this day. I still don't understand that. But she was, all she needed was somebody to empathize with her, because she died 2 weeks later. She had a brain tumor, I understand. But I just never forgot that. I said, this is something weird. And that's how it was back in those days. And so you couldn't really be who you think you all should be.
When you arrive in Ruston and you arrive in the taxi car, how are you received in Ruston?
They didn't say anything too much, but what happened in Ruston was I was driving taxi. See, now this doesn't even make business sense to me. We had kids from Grambling who had to go home during the breaks and stuff, and instead of the bus coming to pick the kids up, we had to bring the kids to the bus station. That's why the taxis had to run. So I was driving taxis to bring kids to the bus station. That's the day I was working full time all day. So I took a trip down there. But that one trip I took had a lady. She must have been, I was around 20, so she had to be at least close to 30, I would imagine. She went down there with me. So I dropped them off, and I came back to get another load. I went back down there, and boy, she was upset about something. She was upset. And the police was there. And she was upset. So I looked and saw her. I said, dang. So I was beginning to back out again to come get another load. So she said, hey, wait. So I stopped. The policeman came over and asked me, he said, do you know who that girl is? I said, I mean, I don't see no girl, but I don't know who that lady is. One guess the way I ended up. And that was nowhere good. You're right. That door slammed on me. I stayed there for 4 hours in jail. President Jones had to come get me out. That's my only interaction of that kind that I had. So I can imagine people who live in that area. I was living in Grambling, so I didn't get that kind of experience. My next experience was I was down getting my driver's license renewed, and the guy who was the manager of the place knew my parents because they kind of grew up in the same area. They were in the same area. So he was laughing and talking to me, telling me about stuff that they had done when they were kids. And I'm, you know, I'm sitting there listening to him. We just talking. And he was a nice guy, you know, real friendly and everything. So coming out the door, I was sat there for about, a long time. When I walked out the door, there was a water fountain right there, and I didn't pay anything. I was thirsty. So I bent over to get some water. Boom! Behind my head. I said, oh, my God. Turn around. This guy was had hit me behind my head. I had done that to hit him, but I said, he had glass on, so I bet I didn't hit him. So I walked out the building. I just walked out the building. And I don't understand this either. I got to my car. I couldn't drive. I was shaking. My whole body, I was just shaking like this, everything. I couldn't control that. I'm sitting there waiting to try to get some composure so I can get the hell out of there, excuse my language. And here come the cop, police and state trooper. We're not going to have any of that food. We're going to have all kind of crazy talk. And we're going to put you in jail and blah, all kind of just crazy stuff. Tell me all kinds. I'm sitting there listening to him talk. You can't say anything. I made my mind. I thought I'm going to kill that. I was going to kill him. I don't know why I was even thinking that way. But then I was getting drafted. So the military, I probably wouldn't have done it, but I thought about it. The military saved me in that respect because I went to the military instead, so I was okay. But it's just that, and I think about it, so that I went through that sporadically. What about the guys who go through this on a daily basis? How, you know, it just kind of bucked me, you know? But I got over it. And I got over it. Mm-hmm. Then when I went to the military, of all places, believe this or not now, I volunteered. I wasn't going to let them draft me. I volunteered to go. So I got in my military outfit, in my basic training company. I was the only black guy in my company for basic training. Okay, it's okay. So I'm the only guy there. But in military, it didn't matter because you're used to busy doing your military stuff. Never cared what you are, I guess. But then when I got out and went to school, In New Jersey, I'm the only guy up there, only black guy up there. That's okay. When I left there and went to Germany, went to my base, I'm the only black guy there. So I was the only black guy for the first year of my class, of my tour. I was the only black guy in my neighborhood. Plus in Germany, I didn't see anybody black. I saw anybody black. Then finally, we got another black man came to my outfit where I was. It's only black. So then the next thing that happened over there, one day I was driving down the road. I could speak German pretty well. And I saw three girls. They were they hitchhiked over there then because they didn't have any cars. They were hitchhiking. Three girls were hitchhiking. And one of them was black. So I stopped, you know, because you pick people up over there. I stopped. And this black girl started talking to me in German, and I couldn't answer her. And I could speak the language, but I said, and I drove. They wanted to go to Frankfurt, and I was on 3-day pass. I could have gone to Frankfurt once. I'm not going to Frankfurt. I'm going. And I got up to Hip Street, and I said, "Wait a minute, I can go to Frankfurt if I want to." I came back, and they were gone.
You had some pretty vivid stories, awful encounters, talking about racial encounters in Ruston.
Yeah.
What were your interactions like in Germany?
In Germany, when I first got there, I couldn't speak the language. So I didn't start speaking the language. I went out, and I met some people who were World War II era people. You know, they lived during the time period. They were more partial to black men than the black people than were white people because they told me during the war, this is what I got. They said during the war, the white soldiers came through and they would just dog them out. You know, which you know. Getting their baby with their boots on, messed their clothes up, just bad, bad, bad. And the black soldiers came through, and they, you know, gave them candy and stuff, food, fed them, you know, stuff like that. Which was so they were more partial to black guys than they were to the soldiers. But they weren't racist. Now they didn't understand that I was black. So you're not black. I said, yeah, I'm black in America. They didn't understand. They didn't even understand that. They didn't understand. I couldn't convince them that I was black. So finally, I got one of my friends came by. I took him down with me. He said, "No, that's black." He was, and they couldn't understand the black-white issue in America. I couldn't make them understand it, but they just didn't understand it. When I was on base, soldiers have a different way of speaking. I don't know if I can say it this way or not, but they have a different way of speaking. You know, everything is SOB this or so, blah, 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 blah. So when I got to Germany, they were talking about, oh, you dumbass WAP, you Kraut, effing Kraut, all kind of stuff, you know. And I was always Bob. And that went on for me. You talk to them, you blah, blah, Kraut, you blah, blah, you blah, 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 and Bob. You know, I was just Bob. I wasn't nothing but Bob. One day I said, you don't think about that if it happened once or twice, but after 8 months of this stuff, I said, wait a minute, hold it. Hold it. I said, what in the hell am I? You know, you all, what am I? This guy from Minnesota turned around. He said, and that covered that broke that. I don't know how you describe that. You can't describe it. That was a something was wrong with that picture. I mean, I see if you something that I can't be anything. I don't know what it is, but it's just something wrong with that, and I can't explain it. Mm-hmm. But once we got through with that, and then they stopped calling each other all those names. They stopped doing all the stuff they were doing. After that encounter, I said, I'd be dang. Mm-hmm. And that surprised me too. But I felt that the only group I had was them, and I was not even a part of that group at all. The way it was, you know, I felt that, you know, I'm excluded from, you know, I'm the only thing here, and I'm excluded from everything. It's weird. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you explain that.
I do want to go back to Ruston, return back to your time mm-hmm. with Crow's Taxi. Presumably, you, Mr. Crow, and then eventually others were doing this because one can assume that the white taxis would not pick up anybody and take them to Grambling.
I don't know. Probably not because I never saw a black man in a white taxi, put it that way. So I don't know. Probably not.
So what about the fare? How much did it cost to
25
get
25 cents.
Both ways or one way?
That's both ways. 25 cents for the round trip. Back then, gas was only about maybe 20 cents a gallon at the time. It was cheap. It was very cheap at the time.
Mm-hmm. What were the roads like getting to Ruston? Because the interstate wasn't.
No. We had what's called Martin Luther King Drive. That was the only way. You had two ways of getting to Ruston, Martin Luther King Drive or Highway 80. And both of them were paved. So the roads were good, you know, comparatively good.
So visitors come into Grambling, if they weren't students in the dormitories, if they didn't live in Grambling, where did you take them?
They stayed with President Jones. They stayed in his house. There were no hotels here, and you couldn't stay in hotels in Ruston because of segregation. You couldn't stay there. Nat King Cole came, and Marion Anderson came, and other people came, but they all stayed at President Jones' house. And my mother worked for President Jones, so therefore I know that they were there because she was there. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when these speakers, when Nat King Cole and the others came in, did Pres Jones go and pick them up, or how did they get?
No, he had a, they would pick them up in his car, but he didn't drive. He had another guy to drive for him.
Do you have any other memories of issues transporting people?
The only one that I really had transporting people was the issue of, I got arrested for saying, I don't see a girl, but I don't know who that woman is. And I got arrested for that. Okay, back in those days, see, you couldn't even try on. If you go to a store, you couldn't try clothes or something on. You couldn't wear something. You couldn't try it on. You know, it was just weird. That was just one guy who was really fair to me. I put it that way. I always had a big foot, and I couldn't wear shoes. You could buy shoes at JCPenney's, but it was cheap. But my foot was always big, and I couldn't buy shoes there, so I had to buy shoes at the shoe store, which was much more expensive. And this guy I met in Ruston, entrepreneur in Ruston, he would allow me to buy shoes and you know, pay as I could without having to worry about paying all at one time, which was good for me. And I don't know why he did it for me, but he did it. And that's my good encounter in Ruston.
You graduate. Continue the story for us. What'd you do next?
Yeah, I got a position in Abbeville. I went down there for a basketball game, accidentally. My wife's high school was playing Harrod High School in Abbeville, so she wanted to go to the game, so I went. When I got down there, I met a guy that I knew, and he said, are you a science teacher? I said, aren't you a science teacher? I said, yeah, I'm a science teacher. We have science positions available. I said, okay, well, whatever. I had a job in a place called Plain Dealing up here in North or somewhere as a coach. I thought I was going to be a coach. But then he said, we got a job. I said, well, I said, my wife needs a job too. I said, I'm trying to get a job. He said, so what's her major? I said, her major's PE. She said, we hire her too. Okay, well, whatever. So two in the hands is better than one in the bush. So I took the two. That's how I got in Abbeville. It was purely coincidental and accidental. Mm-hmm. I didn't even apply for the job. I just got it.
Mm-hmm. What brought you back to Grambling?
My daddy. My dad was 96 years old and getting to the point where he couldn't do for himself like he should have. And I planned to just have a little rent house. I was going to use it as a place to come stay. I planned to just come up here and have a place to stay here and there. But my wife decided she wanted to be here, not that. So she sold the house down there, and I moved. Had to move up here.
So as a resident here now, what do you see as some of the changes, or what do you see as some of the developments between that time and the 40s? And then if you can remind us when you came back here.
2004. When I first came here, the Grambling was concentrated in the two areas. There was from Highway 8 to the campus, that was 15 houses, I believe, on the south end of Grambling, period. That was it. There was nothing on this side of on the west side of R.W. Jones, and nothing on the east side of R.W. Jones, just houses along the street. That was all there. So all that was open space and free space. Staven Drive didn't exist. There was nothing back there, no houses back there at all when I first came here. This right here was a swamp. We sketched frogs in this area when I first came here. After Cottage Avenue right there, north of Carolina, over to R.W. Jones Street, there were a few houses in there, maybe five or six houses in there with people. And after R.W. Jones, there was nothing back there. That was all open field. So it was all open up. When I came back, you see all that's. So it's changed a lot since then. And we used to go in the woods. We used to go around. We'd go out and stay gone. We'd leave. Boys would just could free, roam free. We got roam free and stay going all day long and wouldn't be hungry when we got home. We'd have enough nuts and fruits and stuff in the woods to eat. So you could stay all day in the woods and drink spring water. And you could do all that stuff and stay out all day long and come home full, not hungry. Now you can't do that.
What did I leave out? Is there anything else that you'd like to mention that I didn't ask about?
In Grambling, when I was here in the early part, there were three cars in Grambling I know of. And students had no car. There were no students with a car when I first came here. And actually, the first student with a car on campus was probably me. At least one of the two. And then all that happened after I left.
It was your car?
I delivered newspapers too when I was in high school, and I used that money to buy me a car, an old car, just to deliver papers in.
Yeah. That's the car that you then used to drive for the taxi service?
No, I used Crow's car. That car was, it was an old car. I parked on campus and didn't have enough money to rent it, so it stayed on campus for almost a year before I moved it. Mm-hmm. It was just sitting there.
Yeah. What type of vehicle did you drive for Crow?
It was Chevrolet. It was a Chevrolet, four-door Chevrolet, sedan-type car. Mm-hmm. You could put six people in there, six with the driver, three in the back and two in the front with the driver, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and so a separate car, but the car that you got was for driving a newspaper. What newspaper were you delivering for?
No. I think it wasn't the Russell Lee. There was some. Must be a Monroe paper. Must have been a Monroe paper. I'm not sure. No, Shreveport Times, but it was. It was the Shreveport Times. That's what it was.
Tell me about that. You would drive to Shreveport, pick up the papers?
Back then they delivered them on the bus to the area, and you pick them up down by the junction. You pick them up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Rayburn, I appreciate you being willing to come and share your story today. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Voices of Grambling, a digital oral history podcast. A production of the students and faculty of the Grambling State University History Department, along with faculty at the University of Arkansas. Be sure to listen in to one of our other episodes And if you have a voice you would like to share or have a nomination for a voice that needs to be heard, please contact the History Department of Grambling State University for more information.